Welcome to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Whale, CEO. Many experts believe that China has not played by the rules when it comes to international trade. But dual tariffs, while justified, harm American consumers and producers. What are the long-term consequences, and are the tensions between our two countries simply about trade or about competition for economic supremacy? Joining us to discuss these questions is Yukon Huang. He's a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Moderating the program is my co-host, Marcus Kounalakis. This broadcast is made possible each week by the generous support of Chevron, VMware, and the Draper Richards Kaplan Foundation.
It's my pleasure to have Yukon Huang with us this evening. Last year, he wrote a book called Cracking the China Conundrum. Interestingly, when Dr. Huang wrote his book, which came out last year, right at the end of the 2016 election, he made the prediction that given the trends both in China and in the United States and with the leadership that seemed to be arising, the politics of it, that China and the United States inevitably would enter into a trade war. It seems you were right. So could you perhaps start this evening and, again, welcome and explain what led you to believe that we were going to enter into this now very real trade war?
Well, you begin with this vision of what China and America are all about. And the idea is that they're quite different as countries. But we now have a situation where the leadership is quite similar. So President Xi Jinping and President Trump have a lot of similarities. You have the America First from our side. From China, the China Dream. President Trump was elected with a very strong populist agenda. Xi Jinping has a very strong nationalist agenda. They both have a vision of where they want the country to go. They both wanted more assertive policies. And therefore, it's given where China's coming from and where America, where we are at, and part of the book is saying that a increase in economic intentions is more or less inevitable.
Right. Well, and so, in fact, that inevitability has come to pass. We've seen the imposition of quite significant tariffs from the side of the United States. Of course, the president argues that these are mirroring and that there is a search for reciprocity. But as we sit here tonight, there is a truce in this particular trade war that you predicted would be coming. What can we look for? And maybe you can analyze a bit the trade war itself and its justification, perhaps.
Well, it's interesting because the outcome of this recent agreement led to a surge in the markets. So let's go back and ask what was really agreed upon. And what was agreed upon was a ceasefire. That is, there would be no more hostile acts toward each other. There was no full agreement on the problem, just an agreement that in 9 days the problem will be discussed. So the first interesting point is, why are markets so positive about a problem which has not yet been solved? The framework has not been detailed. Okay, all you've done is shoved it out 90 more days. So what the markets are telling us is they don't like trade wars. Everyone loses in a trade war. Consumers lose, producers lose. Markets hate the uncertainty of a trade war. So I guess the first point I would make is the markets are telling us that a trade war is counterproductive. And they're hoping that it'll just go away. But of course, the issue is will it go away? I guess the other point I would basically saying is people are asking then, what should be done? Is this trade war necessary? And I would say, it's not necessary. There are real issues between America and China, but a trade war does not address them. And then we talked about the inevitability a bit earlier.
Yes.
So you have a counterproductive trade war, a necessary trade war, but ironically, an inevitable trade war. And the key issue then is, how does the U.S. and China sort this out in the future?
Well, if you ask the president, he believes, the president of the United States, that is, he believes that this is something that is winnable and that, in fact, the pressure, starting with a maximal approach to negotiations, is something that will inevitably force the Chinese side and President Xi Jinping into concessions that are favorable, or at least from the President of the United States perspective, mirroring of the types of trade policies that have been pursued in an American perspective, have been exploiting of a world trade reality that has favored, ultimately, the Chinese.
Hmm. Well, the question of whether a trade war is a good tactic that America can use to win, if you think about it, history has shown us that no trade war turns out to be successful from either side. Everyone loses. Why is it that everyone loses? Well, think about this. When you levy $200 billion of tariffs on Chinese products coming in, what are you essentially doing? You're essentially asking American consumers and American companies to pay more.
Yes.
Okay. So how can Americans think they're winning? Because consumers have to pay more, businesses have to pay more. Okay. Then on China's side, of course, prices are higher, so Chinese producers lose. You don't see any winners out of this process. Now, some people would say, well, what about the iron and steel or aluminum companies where the tariffs have gone up? And there are a few companies who actually their profits have surged, but those are relatively very small percentage of the producers. But aluminum, steel, and iron ore, they're used by everybody. So the U.S. automobile makers are actually starting to suffer. People who use these products start to suffer. They far outnumber those who benefit. In essence, a trade war doesn't win. But the question is, does this put pressure on China to negotiate? And I think the answer is probably it won't succeed. That pressure is not a big issue from a China perspective. 10 years ago, trade was 70% of China's economy. It was what I call more trade dependent. Today, it's below 40%. Mm-hmm. It's relatively independent anymore. Trade doesn't generate growth in China. People have this mistaken view that because they're such a big exporting nation and they trade a lot, that that's the reason why they grew so rapidly. In fact, trade is generating negative growth for China for the last several years. It's not a trade promoter. Growth coming from consumption investment, not from trade. So a trade war just generates losses, but it doesn't really actually damage China in some fundamental sense. I mean, the best example is the iPhone. And this is the symbol of the trade war. The iPhone is made in China. All of Apple's products are made in China. Why aren't they making it here? And what I want is for Apple to produce the phones here. So that $800 iPhone that everyone has, that should be produced in America, and Americans will benefit, workers will benefit. The problem is that of that $800 iPhone, only $25 of that goes to Chinese in terms of the assembly. $350 goes to South Korea, Japan, Taiwan for the components. $400 goes to Apple. Incredible profit margin. That benefits Americans. So here, if you want to slap a tariff on these iPhones made in China, you don't really hurt the Chinese. And one of the great ironies of a trade war is that 60% of China's exports to America are actually managed and controlled by American companies. Okay, so that's a great irony here, actually. You end up actually hitting American companies. You think about this issue about tariffs on cars. Take a look at General Motors, for example. That's the predominant American manufacturer. How many people realize that General Motors sells more cars in China than it sells in America? Okay? So we have a fundamental problem. Take Intel, high-tech, major producer of semiconductors. Critical technology. Here's the problem. 80% of Intel's products are bought by China. Suppose you told Intel, I don't want you to be selling your high-tech goods to China anymore. Who's Intel going to sell this to? And this is what I call the big issue. You think this trade war can put pressure on key industries, but very unpredictable who's actually affected. In the end, many American concerns are actually more affected. I mean, that iPhone is made by Chinese workers in China. They're paid $2 an hour. Okay? Suppose you brought it back here and decided you'd have to basically pay workers $25 an hour. Even then, how many people want to slave away in a factory assembling iPhones? Very few. So I think part of this issue in the trade war is the irony is it's really not about trade. This is the great irony. Headlines always, U.S.-China trade war, tariffs. Everyone says, well, this is supposed to be about trade. And the answer isn't about trade, actually, because trade isn't actually the problem. Americans benefit a lot from imports of relatively inexpensive consumer goods from China, and that's improved the living standards here. It's also allowed people to save more and spend. But the tremendous advantage that China has is not in manufactured goods, it's in services and agricultural commodities. So when you look about what China offered to America, to Trump in Argentina, basically say, I'm going to buy more natural gas, or I'm going to buy more soybeans. I can't buy more high-tech goods because you won't sell them to me. Okay.
So this is all fascinating, right? And you know, there are others who would argue that some of this history is, of course, one that has been lopsided. Because if we talk about trade, for example, when you talked about some of these goods, well, the argument would then be, well, during this era when China was, in fact, relying on its exports and on its trade, there was a fair amount of dumping going on with the, for instance, steel and aluminum. When they were developing these goods that were being exported, whether they were in the technology realm or elsewhere, not only were they manufacturing at a very low cost, labor cost, which was beneficial, clearly, to everyone in this room and to American consumers overall, but in the process, there was a fair amount of IP theft in that if you wanted a foreign technology company or anyone who had intellectual property of any sort to be able to participate in the economy in China, whether it's market access or even just being able to manufacture, well, you had to partner with a Chinese company in order to be able to operate within the structure of the Chinese state. And so when you look at it from and take these arguments, then there is the argument of fairness, and which is one that the President of the United States is currently raising on a regular basis and quite loudly, and perhaps even in ways that have overtones of threat to them. But you can see how, in fact, there is an argument to be made that, in fact, there was this long arc of non-reciprocity, unfairness that has allowed for now China, of course, to become a service exporter and for the United States, as you've just described it, to be a provider of commodities rather than of those products that are high value. So how do you then try to balance this? Because it seems to be that the argument that's being made today is we're just trying to right the ship.
I think your description of the issue of unfairness is correct. There is a general perception in America that China's economic policies are unfair, and this needs to be addressed. And I think there are aspects of China's policies which are unfair and need to be dealt with, but they're not trade policies, actually. Let's go back to the perception. One perception is that trade is unfair because China's wages are so low. How can America compete with China's workforce when they're paid so little? But here's the interesting thing. Wages today in China are 7 times as high as they were 10 years ago. Okay? So maybe they had low wages 10 or 15 years ago, but today they're not so low anymore. They're higher than the Philippines and Thailand and Malaysia. No one complains. So how can it be that wages go up 700%, but China's still, in terms of trade, competitive? And the answer, of course, is productivity's gone up a lot. And why? Infrastructure. And of course, this is a major debate here in America.
Sure.
How much should we spend on infrastructure? Well, China spent an enormous amount. How much is enormous? They invest 45% of their income, and a large chunk of that is in infrastructure, 45% investment rate. Here in America, we invest 17% of our economy and hardly anything in infrastructure. So the solution, the problem really, the trade, the advantages didn't come from what I call low wages. It came from productivity increase. But let's go back to the common perception. The common perception is that America has a huge trade deficit and that China was responsible. And then very few people are economists, so I always have a tough time trying to explain to them, is this true or not true? So I go back and look at history. When did America's trade deficit become a huge issue? And the answer is around 1999, year 2000. America's trade deficit became enormous, and it stayed enormous for 3 or 4 or 5 years. And the 9/11 helped boost that up because the government security military expenditures went up a lot. Yes. So America's trade problems surfaced between 1999 and 2003 and 4. Then let's look at China back then. China did not have a trade surplus. It did not have a significant trade surplus at all. How could it be causing America's trade deficit when China doesn't even generate a surplus? Now, actually today, the interesting issue here is America's trade deficit is getting larger. It's getting much larger because the U.S. budget is deficit is getting much larger. Mm-hmm. What about China? China's trade deficit has disappeared. It's likely to run a current account deficit next year. So how can China be causing America's trade problems today when China is not even generating a trade surplus? Okay? But here's a funny issue, though. China may not be generating an overall trade surplus, but it has a huge surplus with America. And the answer to that, of course, is it must have a huge deficit with somebody else that offsets this. And the answer, it does. The commodity producers, East Asia, Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, huge deficits, but then a surplus with the West. Because the West buys the consumer goods, China gets the raw materials, the parts from other countries. China's in balance, but the West is in a deficit. But here's the interesting issue. Why is it that Europe doesn't have a huge trade deficit, but America does? At a global financial crisis, both countries had similar trade deficits, but Europe no longer. But America has a significant one. And that reason is very simple. Europe basically solved its budget problem. It brought its budgets into balance because of the global financial crisis, whereas here in America, we have not done that. So we continue to have a trade deficit problem. Europe no longer does. Europe's generating huge surpluses. But think about this. This really has nothing to do with China. It really has to do with the country's own policies. So that's why I say this issue of a U.S.-China trade war is not about trade. We can solve the trade problem here in America very simply. We just bring our budget, government budget into balance. We won't have a deficit. But the unfairness issue is out there.
Yeah.
And that's not a trade issue. It's a question of unfair investment practices.
Right.
Restrictions on companies coming into America to operate. And they feel like they don't have full liberty to produce what they want and establish companies in a way they would like to. And I think that is a legitimate complaint. And it's particularly strong in services. What is America's strength? America's strength is services, financial services, entertainment services, media services, medical services, engineering services, insurances, everything. This is where China is very restrictive. American firms are handicapped. But think about this. This has nothing to do with manufacturing. It's nothing to do with industrial jobs. It's not about aluminum and autos. It's about services. This is where China really should liberalize. It is unfair to restrict American investment. But I would also add a kind of a footnote. Suppose China liberalized.
Okay.
Open it up.
I'm going to try and imagine that particular scenario.
All right. So all this foreign money from America starts to go into China, investing, because it now has access to market. What's going to happen to America's trade deficit? It's going to get worse because all these American companies are going to go to China, invest, and produce something. And they'll start to export it back to America. So the great irony is if Trump gets his way, if we solve this unfairness issue, the thing that drove this whole problem of trade deficit actually gets worse. Mm-hmm. Okay? And I think this is the great irony that people, one of the reasons why this problem hasn't been solved, because people realize one, it's not about trade. Second, it's about services and foreign investment. But if you solve that, what do you do about the trade issue? It becomes a little bit worse.
Well, it's fascinating because really if those markets were to open up, then of course the expectation is that there would be other types of benefits and that investment would then be also generated in a way that would perhaps offset some of these rising deficits. Isn't that right?
Well, I think that way it would help if you asked or encouraged more Chinese foreign investment to come to America. Because when it comes to America, it creates jobs here, right? But just think what we're trying to do. We're actually trying to tighten Chinese foreign investment coming in.
Yes, through things like CFIUS. And others.
And there's some.
And for those of you who don't know what CFIUS is, maybe you can explain.
Well, CFIUS is an intergovernment panel which scrutinizes foreign investment to see whether there are some security concerns. And I think this is entirely legitimate. there are areas, activities where you would want to make sure that the foreign investment does not get into security issues which would be detrimental to Americans' interests. But there's lots of other areas. When China was trying to buy Smithfield Ham, people said that's a security issue, okay?
For those bacon lovers.
For the bacon lovers. But here's the point here is one of the things that's occurring today is that America's tightening up the restrictions on Chinese investment coming here. So we're tightening up their money coming here. We're asking them to loosen it for us to go there. On balance, therefore, more money's going to go out than come in. And I don't think that's in actually America's interest fully. What you want actually is I would call, a level playing field for both sides. And I think that is a goal that both sides should work toward, and there are ways to achieve this. But right now, tariffs is sort of like the worst means of trying to address this concern.
Yeah, and you make a very good point that in fact, and I think you've made it clear to everyone here, that it's not about trade, in fact, that it is this unfairness of investment practices and policies. And so getting to that level playing field has been difficult. In fact, it seems that the opposite has been happening through policies, the centralized policies of the Chinese government and of Xi Jinping, wanting to dominate certain industries, making sure that his China dream and the China 2025, which is achieving dominance in certain specific fields, including artificial intelligence and other areas of global importance, will not bring us to this level playing field. So the argument, of course, at least with this current administration, is then you have to use what tools you do have,
correct,
which are the trade tools. So it may be the imperfect tool for a problem that it's not actually seeking to solve, but rather trying to solve a different problem through using this as a means to get there.
I think you raise a very good point. Can you justify this tariffs and the trade war as a tactical means? Because we cannot find alternative means that could address this issue. And I think that it begins by trying to figure out what the issue is.
Yeah.
And then figuring out whether we have an instrument to address it. And then you mentioned a very good point that there's concern about this China Made in China 2025, which was implemented or instituted in 2015. In some ways, it's kind of an ironic statement because people would say, I thought everything was already made in China. How can you make any more in China? Well, what the Chinese want to do is to make more high-tech products. So they identify strategic sectors and industries, and it says they'd like to produce more. And this report is cited something like 80 times in America's study outlining the basis for the trade war. Basically, we do not like this. It is likely to lower America's competitive innovative advantages. It's an issue of a rising power challenging the technological supremacy of the dominant power, and this is a big issue. This is part of what I call the inevitability.
Mm-hmm.
And then the issue becomes, well, every country has the right to be or want to be more innovative and technologically advanced, poor countries or rich countries, everyone does. The question is that China's not doing it fairly. And this, I think, is a legitimate concern. And the general concern is that China subsidizes its industries. And this is unfair. And so what I talk about is the issue would be, do we in America subsidize our industries or not? $100 billion a year are spent by local governments in America to attract investments to their areas. So Amazon was shopping around for a second headquarters. Washington, Virginia, where I live in Washington, you have to offer tax benefits, free land, everything else to get them to come. Football team wants to move. Everyone offers a free stadium and everything else. So we spend $100 billion localities.
Yeah, let's stop doing that.
Some people would say this is unfair. As an economist, I don't think it's a good thing, actually. I don't think localities should be competing with each other, mm-hmm. but we do. Toyota moves to a factory in Tennessee. They provide all sorts of subsidies, okay? Mm-hmm. But we also do this through the federal government tax system and programs. We subsidize new industries. Those in the audience, for example, who buy electric cars, install solar panels on their houses, geothermal heating systems, you get a huge tax write-off to encourage you to buy these products. Then companies get a huge depreciation allowance to produce them. So that's how we subsidize, and we subsidize over the place. Now, here's the problem. when you go to the Chinese and say, you are not doing, or you're supporting unfairly your industries, you should be doing what we do. Here's what we do. We do it through the tax system, largely through deductions and local governments providing funding. And China will say, sorry, our people don't pay taxes, okay? Our households don't file returns, okay? We don't have deductions. Our companies don't have depreciation schedules which are clear and confident. How can we subsidize our industries? Our system is, remember, we're a developing country. We have a per capita GDP of 9,000. Your per capita GDP is 60,000. Your people are very familiar with tax systems and incentives. We don't. So we subsidize through land transfers, and we subsidize through credit flows through the banking system. And we in America would not do this. First of all, our banks are all private. Their banks are largely state. So you have a fundamental problem. It's not the principle of subsidies which is actually wrong or unfair. It's that we have different ways of doing it. And then when you think about it, your question is, how do you solve it? I don't know how you solve it.
I was looking for an answer.
Okay. You can't solve this. You could only solve it by saying both sides should stop subsidizing.
Yeah.
Okay?
Okay, I'm good with that.
Okay, and I think I could be good with that. But a practical matter, you have to start at home also.
Yeah. Well, and you raise this issue of the type of structures that are true of both sides as well, right? Which is, on the one hand, you have state-owned banks and state-owned enterprises, and on the other, you have shareholder-owned industry for the most part, right? And so that raises the question, of course, that is more strategic, which is, do you have industries that are necessarily aligned with the state agenda and a state strategic geopolitical interest, or do you have industries that are actually seeking a profit? Have a profit motive at its core, and returning shareholder value as the driving motivation towards it, which can often go counter to national strategic interests. So I think that it sometimes feels like we're comparing apples to oranges, in that when you are dealing with a state-owned enterprise, whether it's a question of subsidy or not, the alignment of those institutions with the state is so perfect, or if it's not, will be made to be perfect, versus one which is wholly independent and is trying to take advantage of whatever subsidies may exist, but not necessarily returning to the state its strategic interests.
Right. Well, I think you've nailed another issue which I think is difficult to resolve: the dominance of the state is ownership and running of enterprises and activities in China. And compare that with us here in America, where we basically say the market should dictate and operate it. And that changes the way this economy is run. It changes accountability. It even has what I would call a major influence on whether or not democracies or participatory systems evolve or don't evolve. I think this is a big issue. Here's what you get from a Chinese perspective, however. And in my book, I write about this. Actually, China and America have a similar kind of a problem. Our companies in America are too big to fail, and they're getting bigger and bigger. Whether it's in the internet business, or in the banking system, or the companies, companies are fading out and disappearing and being bought out. And we have a problem here in America because, as it was with the car sector, we can't let them fail. We have to figure out how to regulate them and promote them. China has a slightly different problem. Its state enterprises are so big, they're too big to manage. Okay? They've become uncontrollable. They go overseas and do various things, and the government doesn't even know what they're doing anymore. So I think both countries have a problem in terms of size, but the nature of ownership changes it. So we still have a problem in America in saying, what happens if the financial banking sector gets such that there's only one or two banks in the whole country? And we're getting there. What happens if a Facebook or a Google and other dominates the whole sector?
Yeah.
Okay? Or Amazon takes over all our distribution activities? Okay? I don't know the answer to that, but here's what China says. I see that America is becoming bigger and bigger and bigger and getting more concentrated.
Yeah.
Okay? And I'm trying to catch up. So I'm going to try to support getting big. And of course, that means preserving the state entity's ownership.
Yeah.
So here's the huge challenge for China. Can I do this? Does it make sense? Will I become inefficient? And the problem, of course, is these state companies in China, they're too big to manage, and they're starting to lose too much money. So it is an issue. It is a conflict between America and U.S. The solution, again, is not so obvious.
We've been hearing from Yukon Huang. He's in conversation with Marcos Kounoulakis on the long-term consequences of the U.S.-China trade war. Join us after the break as we consider the underlying causes of the trade war. You're listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. We're hearing from Yukon Huang. He's a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Moderating the program is Marcos Kounoulakis. To hear this broadcast or any other World Affairs program that you may have missed, you can download our podcasts on our iTunes channel or wherever you get your podcasts. Search for World Affairs. That's one word. And now back to our program.
You raised an important question as you talked about this, because you said, well, what do you do when there's consolidation in the marketplace? And as we're seeing, and as you raised with these very large organizations like Facebook, which are much larger than you have a GDP or have a financial statement that's much larger than the GDP of many nations. And the answer, of course, has been that traditionally in the United States, after you go through a fair amount of pain and suffering with these organizations consolidating, you have regulation and you have antitrust actions, and we haven't yet achieved that, but it sounds at least currently that those noises are being made in Washington, that recognition is occurring, but that, for example, should China have similar problems, which is large, unmanageable institutions and structures, will there be a regulatory imposition? Will there be the attempt at antitrust? Or do those structures actually get reinforced to grow and become singularly important by the state and by the leadership?
I think that's a fundamental difference. The challenge in America is regulation.
Yes.
What's the proper way to regulate utilities, regulate these internet? These companies are getting too big. And as you say, it is a discussion, it is being addressed, but we don't have exactly the answer yet.
No. We'll come up with it by the end of the evening.
You have the security issues, you have the issue of whether individuals own the information, does the government own the information, do the companies own the information. Now you have the Chinese system where the state owns everything.
Right.
Okay. So regulation is not the key issue. The issue for them is, I own, I manage it. The problem in China, how do I get an adequate return to society from my ownership? They have not achieved that fully. And this is, when you look at the policy agenda for the Xi Jinping's government, I think the number one unresolved issue. Now, this gets caught up in the trade war, okay? The trade war sees these state-managed companies and sees this as part of the unfairness issue, that these companies owned by the state, managed by the state, how can American companies compete with them? And my answer to this question is, that is an issue, but it's not actually the trade war issue. These state companies in China account for 10% of China's exports. They're a non-factor in this trade war. But people think actually it's the target. Remember, the bulk of the products coming from China to America, they're actually managed by American companies, not by Chinese companies.
So we'll stop talking about trade as the problem, and we'll really focus on some of these other fundamental internal issues that are true of China. And you know, one of the things that I think we often have a hard time understanding is the whatever domestic contradictions may exist, or the inability of the state to deliver a return on the investment of the Chinese people to the people. And we see that whether it be in the inequalities that exist within the economics of the state, and the inequities that exist in the populace with the very rich and the very poor as well, undeveloped areas of the country. But these are things that we often are not exposed to because it is such a large state. It is so complex. It is dominantly uni-ethnic, right? It is dominantly a Han Chinese population, so we don't have the complexity or diversity of the United States in its populace. But nonetheless, we can't extrapolate in any generalized way about the Chinese state when we look at it from the outside because of these complexities. You know, at this time of the of our discussion, I usually turn to the audience questions and try to weave them into anything that I'm really interested in. And but we'll talk about, we've gotten some interesting questions, some very specific. You know, we have a number of people who work in the high-tech field who are probably in the audience, and one of the questions is, how will China's investments in the semiconductor industry affect U.S.-China dynamics?
Here's the problem. The semiconductor industry is seen as one of America's great strengths.
Yeah.
And I think it's probably rightly seen by American policymakers as not just strictly an economic issue, but also a security issue, because semiconductors are used in so many ways that they have both security and economic concerns. The problem, however, is that China is the major consumer of semiconductors. It purchases about 70-80% of the semiconductors made in the U.S.
Right, you were talking about Intel earlier.
Yeah. It's therefore unrealistic, actually, to think that a country which buys 70% of something doesn't have a capacity to manufacture some of it, especially when it is the manufacturing industrial growth. So slowly what China's been trying to do is to try to get in at the lower ends. Intel has a factory in China. It's transferring knowledge to produce basic semiconductors and other things, but not the high tech. The high tech research and development of Intel's best is done only in two places, here in the United States and in Israel. Otherwise, they will not do it anywhere else because of security concerns. I think the trend that will continue is that China will put a lot of effort into developing semiconductor industries. It's going to be extremely expensive and difficult. It is becoming a big source of controversy because America, in the last couple months, started to put a prohibition on the export of the equipment which is used to make semiconductors. Okay, and this is a big issue because there are companies in China. The only equipment they use are American equipment. So they'll go out of business if they don't have access from this.
Right.
So the key issue of this trade war is not actually going to be this tariff rate or those kinds of things. It's going to be policies like that. Controls on exports, which if implemented could actually wipe out major companies in China. Okay? And then from a Chinese perspective, that's a big security issue. How can I be so vulnerable to outside suppliers of something which is so integral to my economy? So I am going to wrap up investment and every means to get the knowledge to do so. And this, is a huge question coming up.
Well, you know, it relates to another question that we have here from the audience, which is, as we look at these industries evolving and trying to protect themselves and making sure that they can survive within China, part of what has been occurring has been the acquisition of intellectual property, both by legal means and by illicit means. And the question from the audience is, what is your suggestion for the United States to deal with the intellectual property theft issue with China?
Well, I think we should first try to clarify that theft of intellectual property is illegal and should not be allowed. and I think China would agree with this. So when you talk about the criticism that China steals, the answer is if China steals, it should be penalized. You should take them to the courts. There are courts for this purpose. Now, realistically, if you talk about a lot of the cases which are small, they're going to be prosecuted in courts in China. And the accusation before was the Chinese courts were not fair, or they're too slow, or if you won a case, you didn't get paid enough. And I think that that's certainly a legitimate concern. But here's the problem. So-called neutral strong courts were established in Beijing, Shanghai, and Shenzhen only 2 years ago. So you're not talking about a history of being able to deal with these kinds of cases, but you're fundamentally talking about a change in Chinese system that they're willing to deal with this. So after two years ago, they established in these three major cities. Last year, they broadened it to 10. So there are now about a dozen courts dealing with IPR theft issues in China, which I would say a vast improvement. Still need a lot of work. Now, here's the interesting case. 10 years ago, 80% of the cases would be brought by foreigners accusing Chinese of theft. Today, most of the cases are Chinese accusing Chinese of theft. That's one fundamentally important difference. The second thing I think is interesting is 90% of the cases where foreigners file a claim, they win. That wasn't the case 10 years ago. So China would say, I've got a problem. I'm trying to resolve it, but I can't solve it immediately. And we who operate in a legal system realize how difficult it is to revamp and change your whole court system to solve a problem. So it's not something that's neglected. It's something that has to be addressed, but it cannot be solved instantaneously.
Sure. And I think some of the industry might say, well, you know, I'm loath to go to a court because of the repercussions of actually calling out a
Correct.
Chinese partner and risking my distribution, my partnership, my business, really within the country. So would be conservative and would have to really consider seriously legal action. And it's not always these black and white cases either, right, where we have this case of a outright theft. Often these areas are much grayer, where it's a intellectual property acquisition or the handing over through partnership of intellectual property that's being used by an industry. I recently read about a particular case where Chinese investors had come to the United States and were looking at early stage technology companies putting in deposit, looking for a serious investment, making sure that during the due diligence they were exposed to everything that they would like to see to make sure that the technology was going to be of interest to them, demanding a fair amount of transparency from the company that they were about to acquire, and then at the end were unable to make the investment,
right,
calling force majeure, saying that the Chinese state won't let me export the money. And by the way, because of force majeure, because I'm not allowed to export the money and to invest in this company, I want my deposit back as well.
Okay.
And so there's a spectrum of how one can actually acquire intellectual property that isn't necessarily going in at night, breaking into somebody's file box and then stealing the chip.
And I think that is the issue. It's not the theft, it's these other aspects.
Yeah.
But think about it. Here we live in San Francisco. You go down to Silicon Valley. What is Silicon Valley? It's
bunch of office buildings.
It's an industry which is built on transfer of technology.
Yeah.
Startups build up and establish a new technology. What happens next? It's sold to somebody. That's a transfer. That's considered good. Or they have a joint venture arrangement. Joint ventures force transfer of technology is the key to this state. It's the key to America's growth. So there's nothing wrong with this. Now let's go a step further. Is there forced transfer of technology in America? I'm not talking about this voluntary collaboration. The answer is yes, a hostile takeover. We have companies that take over another company by buying them all out, and that company doesn't want to sell, but they eventually have to, or something happens. Hostile takeovers are also part of the competitive scene in America. So whether it's a voluntary joint venture or a hostile, transfers occur, and that's why America grows. And we accept that as good for innovation, right?
Oh, it's great if it's within one nation. But
within one nation. Across nations makes it more difficult,
much
right?
Much more difficult.
Okay.
And strategically much more threatening.
So in my book, I talk about America. Who was the first great innovator in America? Francis Cabot Lowell, Harvard graduate 100 years ago. He established the Industrial Revolution in America, right? Mm-hmm. How did he do it? He went to England. When he got to England, what did he find? He realized that England was wealthy because it had the power loom. Mm-hmm. Made it wealthier than France, Germany, everything else. Only England had it. If you worked in the power loom sector in England, you were not allowed to travel for fear of losing the secret to the power loom. So what did Francis Cabot Lowell do? He spent 6 months, and he's brilliant. He went around there. He memorized it. He put it in his head. He came back to Lowell, Massachusetts, reproduced the entire factory, launched the Industrial Revolution. So if you Google Francis Cabot Lowell in the Wikipedia, not WikiLeaks, he will be called America's first great innovator.
Right.
He's also America's first great IPR thief.
Yes.
Okay? And then history shows that everybody steals. Now, here's the problem. If you're poor, you steal from countries which are richer. If you're the richest, you don't find anybody to steal from because you have all the thing. So Intel doesn't steal. Infill creates because it's at the top. Now, this is the problem I think that's a really tricky issue. Should we encourage the transfer of technology or IPR knowledge from rich countries to poor countries? That's the question. Because rich countries develop it. They have to develop it. They already have it. They're not going to get it from a poor country. They're way advanced. So they develop it. Poor countries don't. They don't spend enough on R&D. They're not capable of it. They tend to get it, legally or illegally, right?
Yep.
So this question of unfairness depends upon whether we think this is good or bad, that rich countries transfer technology to poor countries. Should we discourage it, control it, restrict it? And the question is there an internationally recognized principle guiding this? Because fairness requires some kind of a norm, right? So Google WTO. Every member of WTO has signed on to a statement. And surprisingly enough, there's a statement about technology transfer. Surprisingly, not unsurprisingly, practically no one's ever read it. What this statement says, it says rich countries are obligated to provide every incentive to transfer technology to poor countries. Obligated. Now we accuse China for unfairness because they do it so well. Okay? But here's then the problem. Is China a poor country? Is China a developed country? So actually the debate about unfairness is really not about unfairness.
That's right.
It's about whether China is a developing country or developed. China claims it's developing. Its income is 1/6 that of America. America claims that China is not a developing country. They would claim that China is a developed country. So Chinese and American negotiators get together, the American negotiators say to the Chinese, I see a very rich country with some poor people. And the Chinese will say, we're actually a very poor country with a fair number of rich people. Okay? And that's the debate. Because if China was not a developing country, it no longer sort of like benefits from this kind of philosophy that you want to encourage the transfer of technology to them.
Right. Well, and of course, the complexity of all of this is that, you know, back in Lowell's day, you required 6 months away. Now it's really just two clicks away, right? I mean, it really is just a matter of seconds rather than months, and dissipates that whatever competitive advantage may have existed during that technology transfer, I mean, which allowed for the new technologies to be evolving. Like, I think in your litany of things that concern those in the West and the United States in particular, when we look at how investment is being made and how the state operates, is the concern that some of the societal and political norms that are established in China that are being projected upon industries that are operating within that country are now being globalized, right? And these include whether or not certain websites or newspapers or others must take a perspective that is a dominantly Beijing-oriented perspective. And I'll use the example of one of the major hotel chains that recently solved its labor problems but didn't solve its China problem when it recognized or identified Taiwan as being a separate entity than the People's Republic of China. So the idea that, in fact, Chinese norms and Chinese perspectives can be imposed upon institutions that are American or German or others. And so I think there's a great fear, and it seems a quite justified fear, that there is this forced movement towards an acceptance of Beijing norms.
My view about this is an overblown worry.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I was born in China, but I came over to America when I was five, so I've lived in Washington for half a century. And my point about the Chinese norms and American norms, I've lived in both countries now for long periods of time, and I say to myself, here in America, I think we're far too sophisticated and knowledgeable to be influenced by some of these Chinese practices, which people think are ideologically, you know, going to shift us. I don't think they're actually trying very hard either, actually. They're more likely to be successful in trying to establish culinary institutes than Confucius institutes. I don't think anyone's going to be persuaded by some of what I call the ideological messages that come out of there. China's basic position is, I'm not here to change your political system. And here in America, there are people who don't accept that. They think they are. But I don't think they are. Their basic view is there are different systems. And none of them are very perfect, but we each have our own. What I do want is recognition that we can collaborate and get along in a world where there are different systems. So I don't want to actually force mine on yours, nor do I want you to force yours on mine. Now, I think that this is getting tougher. Why is this particular view getting tougher now? Why is it generating more tension than it was 10 or 15 years ago? Part of it is, I think, the South China Sea disputes, where China's assertiveness gives a sense that they want to do something more and that something more may constrain America's foreign policies. It's the One Belt, One Road, where China's trying to build these bridges all through Central Asia to Europe. And the issue here being, do these initiatives have longer political strategic interests which threaten America's way of life or thinking? And I think, sitting here in Washington, I can understand this very easily. When I go to China, I look around, and I say, my gosh, I don't think anyone there is even thinking about this or cares. It isn't in the minds of anybody, okay? I think, therefore, it's an exaggerated but a legitimate concern. And then the question is, how do you deal with this? And here's where I think it comes up in the trade war. Because the third war leg of the trade war in terms of how you respond to it is this issue of, should America start to disengage from China? You know, separate our economies, our relationships, because of this concern that you mentioned, mm-hmm. that they're trying to spread this. And I would say that is really just illogical.
Yeah.
Okay.
And in fact, there is a report that just came out recently. It was released in Washington, D.C. It was co-sponsored by my host organization, the Hoover Institution. And in fact, I was a part of the working group and task force, which does not call for a break from engagement, but rather calls for what is referred to as constructive vigilance, which is an understanding that there needs to be more transparency, greater integrity, and reciprocity. Those are the three main points that are sought in this new approach towards the relationship with China. And yet again, we're not talking about trade wars within this, because it really is about these fundamental issues that that the United States is looking for. Let me go back to one more question here from our audience, and this is one where I'm going to ask you to look into your crystal ball. Fast forward 20 to 30 years, what is the U.S.-China relationship going to look like? Mm. And does somebody win? Because that's what the president likes to talk about, is winning.
You know, I'm not a foreign policy expert or international relations. I'm an economist. And so I look at all these issues from an economic perspective, and then I try to get a foreign policy bent. I think it's something to me which is interesting. Right now we have this tremendous amount of tensions. Is it coincidental? Why did it occur now? So I have a graph in my book which traces the share of global production of America, Europe, and China. Mm-hmm. And if you think about it, China always talks about long term, right? So 200 years ago, China accounted for 35% of global production. Huge. By 1980, that 35% fell to 3%. the sharpest decline we've ever seen, but over 200 years. So 1980, China accounts for 3% of the global production. America and Europe, by the way, are accounting for about 20-25% each. 1980. So China starts to grow very rapidly. Today, its share is 17% of global production. It's exactly the same as America and Europe. This year, okay? So these three entities have exactly the same share of global production today. Now, graph trade, exports and imports, is a share of the total. By coincidence, Europe, US, China, exactly the same today, okay? So no wonder we're experiencing this sense of tension. Economic, rising power, threatening America. It's real, it's an issue. So then your question is fast forward. What will it be like in 2030, okay? So here's China growing at 6.5%, but let's assume it's not gonna grow at 6.5%. That's too high. So assume China grows at 4% for the next 12, 15 years, okay? America and Europe grows at 2.5%, which is a solid rate. China's share of global production will be 25%. America's and Europe's will fall down to about 12%. So it'll be twice as large in purchasing power terms. So that's the alarming thing of the people who are interested in global politics. Gosh, China's going to be here, we're going to be here, it's going to be a problem. But here's the problem. The size of the economy does not determine your political or strategic power. It's actually your per capita GDP. That's the quality of your institutions, your soft power, your military strength. It's not the overall size. It's how deep and sophisticated you are as a country, okay? Here's something people don't realize. A China which grows at twice the rate of America, China's per capita GDP gap with America continues to get wider. It doesn't narrow. An America that grows at 2.5% a year, which is solid, in my view, will perpetuate its global economic dominance, its security, its military, its soft power for the foreseeable future. So for America, living here in America, the key issue in America is to make sure that we continue to grow at a reasonable rate, that we spend it properly, that we continue to innovate and build we don't have to worry about a rising China in what I call a true power sense. And that's why I think this war is inevitable but unnecessary, okay? And the threat, if you make it a threat, it's sort of like far-fetched threat. And those who are my military colleagues realize that there is no way that China in a military sense can be competitive in foreseeable future. But the quality of the institutions, the soft power, the innovation, those kinds of ideas, you're talking about a gap that spans more, maybe 50, 60, 70 years, not a five-year issue. But here we are, we're all intersecting today. Very logical that people feel the pressures. Crystal ball ahead and then ask, what do we do about it? Okay, and I think that is a legitimate debate.
Dr. Yukon Huang, thank you so much.
Welcome.
It's been really fascinating.
You've been listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. Ours is a nonprofit membership organization. We're dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter. Visit us at worldaffairs.org. This program featured Yukon Huang. He's a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. The conversation was moderated by Marcos Kounalakis. This broadcast is made possible each week by the generous support of Chevron, VMware, and the Draper Richards Kaplan Foundation. Our technical supervisor is Jim Bennett. World Affairs is produced in association with KQED Public Radio. I'm Jane Wales. Thank you for joining us.